Hello, and welcome to Community and University, the MSU Center for Community and Economic Development podcast aimed at providing outreach to both community members and students throughout the state of Michigan. I am Heather Mahoney, and I'm the producer for Community and University. Today on Community and University, we have Bob Brown, director of the Flint Center for Community and Economic Development, interviewing Pastor Tommy, a citizen in Flint who assists in running the Help Center that operates out of the church he serves.
So this is Bob Brown from the Center for Community and Economic Development in Flint. And today I'm talking with Pastor Tommy, who is at Asbury United Methodist Church. That is one of our help centers in the community that's responding to our ongoing water and lead crisis. And Pastor, I wonder if you might start by telling us a little bit about the help centers, the history of your help center. It got closed down and then it's reopened. If you could trace a little bit of that for us.
So the three help centers was a community partner response to a way that we could make not just bottled water, but other human necessities available to the public. So it began there, and we ultimately had plans for six locations so that we could cover the city well, north, south, east, west, and in between. And we were able to raise sufficient funding that we were able to open three of the six. And the idea was to provide food that, through a nutritional basis, had been, I'll call it, prescribed by health professionals, that contain the nutrients that our bodies need to be able to mitigate to an extent the negative impact of lead. And that I talk about that because for us at Asbury, that has been our focus as we try to shift to the extent we can from a crisis approach, an emergency response, to a longer-term response, which will be required over the next couple of generations. The help centers then were what we call point of car. It means cars drive through the parking lot and we put the groceries and bottled water into the vehicle. And they have had the option of pulling over and parking in our parking lot and going inside. And in the past, we've provided personal items and other water-related resources like filter cartridges, zero pitchers for a while. And as the funding began to run out, and the funding is quite complicated in its own right, in the sense that the state of Michigan was providing the budget for food, through a Department of Labor grant, Work Alliance, or Michigan Works, was providing the labor that was there on a consistent basis. And the bottled water then was also budgeted separately, and that came through a state-allocated budget. And we essentially ran out of money. The Department of Labor grant was coming to an end. Apparently, the water crisis was beginning to be declared over, and the water was improving, at least the tests that they were holding dear to. And so we closed down, but that was the basic idea. I call it somewhat it's not intended to be negative, but a superficial relationship, the kind you have, you know, when you go through McDonald's and pick up your order, as opposed to a relationship where you're able to help our residents and point them toward other services. But I will say, though, particularly Genesee Health Systems, but a number of different organizations would stand out there and greet the people waiting in line and ask questions and do surveys and try to give them at least the information that they needed. And I think people really appreciated that.
So you were open 4 or 5 days a week?
We were open Monday through Thursday, 4 days a week, and we opened at 10 a.m. and we were open until 4:30 p.m.
And in this new revised way of doing it, without those streams of funding and without those streams of labor support, what's the structure like now?
Okay, so we reopened after being closed for a 2 to 3 weeks. We scrambled because we kind of knew it was coming, but at the same time, what we also didn't know was what was going to happen with state funding in particular. And so we reopened, but at this point we have 1 day a week, and for Asbury it's on Tuesdays, but there's also Bethel United Methodist Church on Mondays, and Greater Holy Temple on Thursdays. Our hours are a bit shorter. We open at 10 a.m. still, but we close at 2 p.m. And so the 1 day a week in each of three help centers, West Side, North Side, and East Side.
The other big difference is the bottled water that was not advertised as being available because nobody knew if indeed that was going to be available.
Right. So the reality is that we weren't anticipating, and we were told not to anticipate bottled water, and lo and behold, Tuesday morning, a truck shows up full of cases of water. Well, I say full of cases of water. We don't know how much water is going to come. And we did say, and I remember one of my peers, Greg Timmons, telling the Channel 12 that we don't know. Water would be available as we could make it available. And so the reason Greg said that is the same reason I would have said that, and that is we've had offers, we've had calls from around the country with people wanting to know what they could do. And providing bottled water has been one of the calls that people have made. And so it'll be on a limited basis, but what we have to do is sort of assess, okay, how much do we have, how many cases, divide it by roughly 325 and say, okay, we can give 1, 2, 3 cases to each vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a huge change over families that had larger needs being able to leave our premise with, 6 to 12 cases of water as they might need.
So this past Tuesday was your reopening.
Yes.
So what was that day like?
Hectic, but organized hectic. We sort of suspected we would see long lines, and these were long lines. You know, when you're open 4 days a week, people sort of get into a pattern, and our crew was efficient enough that we seldom had vehicles backed up on the main road. And yet we served hundreds of vehicles each day that we were open. But you compress the hours, you compress the days, and you scare the dickens out of everybody with a last-minute bomb drop that you're no longer going to provide water, and guess what? They show up. And so an hour before we were open, traffic was backed up on the main road way down several blocks.
Yeah, on Thursday I went to Greater Holy Temple, and the experience there was identical.
Yeah,
they were lined up out of the driveway, down the major highway that they're located on, probably 2 or 3 blocks. There could have been 100 cars in line waiting to get in.
Right.
So it was very, very busy. And I know that this might be a guess on your part because you're not actually in the parking lot doing the actual distribution. But did you run out of water, or did you have enough water? What did it seem like?
Well, we knew we would run out of commodities before the line stopped. There's no doubt about that. We had an idea ahead of time of how many cases. We know that the food that we're provided in what's called a nutrition truck has been designed to for 325 vehicles to each get their bag of food and their potatoes and so forth. And so we did the same thing with cases of water. So did we run out of water? Well, yes, but we also ran out of food. In our particular case, I guess the good news is we've been doing this long enough now, we feel that our staff is quite proficient. But still, people were coming by, and they do come by. They come by every day, and they're not mean. They're not, you know, upset with us. They're just simply, you know, what can I do? And when we explain to them that when the other help centers are open, they're appreciative. And that has been a pleasant surprise because, you know, there's a lot of anxiety. But the good news is I think all of the churches, not just the three help centers, but other churches have built good, long-term, lasting relationships with our neighbors, and they know we're in this together.
So you are also the largest site that delivered to homebound folks, delivered water to homebound folks.
Right.
What's happening to that?
Well, that's a bigger mystery. You know, the part I suppose is not a mystery is that the warehouse is going to be empty and we're going to run out of water. And we are not going to hold on to our staff beyond when there are means to pay for those staff. We have maintained a fleet of three box trucks, I mean three commercial trucks, and in our best days we had three people in each truck, so we had a staff of nine, and they were able to deliver to around 1,100 households a week.
Wow.
And our total distribution is about 1,400 different households, so some households would be delivered to less than once a week. Some really needed to have deliveries every week. And they would take the water up and put it on the kitchen table or on the kitchen floor, whatever the families needed. But in addition to that, it's one of the things that was very heartwarming is these crews built relationships with the families they were serving. The families were, very seldom was there ever an issue. And they knew that if they didn't get water, something happened, they were at a doctor's appointment or something, that you know, they wouldn't get forgotten. So what's going to happen to that? Well, if we listen to the to the political pundits, what's going to happen to that is we're not going to be able to do it anymore. We're not going to have the resources. These trucks are quite expensive. They use a lot of fuel. And volunteers can do this for a few days, but not for months.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the most vulnerable of the families. They tend to be a group that struggles with, you know, if they have mobility issues, trying to know how to change their filter and their sink. They have, you know, they're sort of at the mercy of those of us who are healthy enough and mobile enough that we can bring them what they need.
So what was the reaction of the crews? They had built relationships with these families,
right,
and then suddenly they had to stop, and it was very suddenly. And then with the pods closing down also, all water just stopped.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure all the way around. Well, it varies quite a bit. I mean, in general, my sense is they have loved their jobs, and it was a better job, I think, than they ever expected it to be in terms of how rewarding it was. But all along, there seemed to be this understanding of, well, this is only temporary. We're going to do what we can while we can do it. And we did what we could to encourage them to seek full-time employment in other places, you know, offered to provide references, whatever they would need, because we knew it was going to be temporary. We would rather it not be as temporary as it is, because we still have a water problem. It's just that at this point, and I don't want to say the world has decided, you know, get over it. What I'm saying at this point is the people who should be held accountable seems to be the ones that are not holding themselves accountable, whereas many people around the country and around the world, you know, when they learn it's not over, number one, they're not shocked, and number two, they presume that we're still getting help, and when they find out we're not, many of them offer to help.
So along that line, what was your reaction on this past Monday when our mayor met with the governor?
Right.
And within a matter of minutes, according to her. His statement to her was, you all just need to get over it and move beyond it.
Yeah, I'd like to say my reaction was disbelief, but it's unfortunately not. We find ourselves in a kind of a new way of being in the world with our leaders, led by the one in the White House, who you're allowed to tweet anything that happens to come to your mind at any time of the hour or night. The good news is we kind of know what they're made of, and we kind of know what their ethics and their morals are. The bad news is they're in office, and they seem to have a lot of influence over lives that, you know, I'm sort of angry with us, the public.
Yeah.
You know, and we live in a democracy, and we give that kind of power to people that are going to say things and mean them. Why don't you just get over it? And that perhaps is what is pervasive at this point throughout the country.
Yeah, that whole aspect of democracy, and many people might not remember this, but this crisis occurred when the democracy of this city was stripped away from us.
Absolutely.
And we had no voice in decisions that were being made
right.
that affected us.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's I had the pleasure, I guess, the honor of participating, and this was a church discussion, but we were looking at issuing a resolution that would condemn the ability of government to do that, to take away that kind of power. And I found myself being, first of all, the only one from Flint, and second of all, in a room full of people that saw no reason why we should be putting forth a resolution that says, you know, that we disagree with this.
Yeah.
And the good news is, I'll tell you, by the time we finished the debate, the resolution passed. And so what that meant was our bishop was asked to weigh in on this conversation and to say, at least the members of the United Methodist Church who live in Michigan have determined that we believe that this is an ability to take away government that you shouldn't have. And so we've asked our members to stand up in opposition to that. Doesn't mean they will. We all have free will, and
yep.
This is not we also have a democracy. And so it may not be that way, but I feel good about at least being able to have the conversation.
Yeah, I want to turn our conversation a little bit to another area, and I'm going to use my house and my family as an example. So we tested really high for lead. Mm-hmm. Anything over 15 parts per billion, according to the government, is bad. Anything over 0 parts, according to the scientists and doctors, are bad.
Right.
There's no level of lead that's a good thing.
Right.
And we tested at 200 parts per billion in our house. Right. I was able to change all the pipes. I have 2 whole house filters. We're down to testing at 0. And I still can't bring myself to drink out of the tap.
Right.
So it's that trauma, that psychological trauma that's still sitting there, even though I've had the money to replace everything. Most people in Flint don't have that option.
Right.
How long do you think that trauma is going to persist? And that's the key issue right now. Even if the pipes are okay, the trauma is still here.
Right, yeah. So I've hurt you and potentially damaged you for not only your life, but your children's life. And you know, you should get over that trauma, I guess, is what we're talking about. And how long will that trauma last if we don't get over it right away? You know, it's... There's a number of things at play here, and I first of all, my own personal sense of this is that not only do you deserve, if you will, to be able to have the emotions that you have and the rest of us have, but it might be wise to have that level of skepticism. You know, you and I are relative insiders, and we know that you know, not all is well with the world and in the world of Flint and the world of water. There are still questions about chlorine levels, for example, and therefore questions about bacteria that can't necessarily be taken out by the filters that we tend to use in our homes. Asbury runs a commercial urban farm, and we're working with Kettering on a project to harvest water, so it's a water catchment systems. And we know that we need to filter that water. We can't, the food safety laws on the farm are similar to what they are in the kitchen, you know, with the new act that went into effect into law this year, and which, by the way, I think is a good law. And so we need to test our water. And it, whether we use Flint City water or we use water that we catch. But we're looking at technology to make sure there's no bacteria in the water. So when our harvesters wash their hands before they harvest spinach or lettuce, we want that water to be free of bacteria. You know, I think it's wise because we have this water infrastructure that clearly is a problem. And we have an infrastructure that was built for, you know, maybe 300,000 is the number I've heard. And we have 100,000 or less residents. And we have more and more homes that are being abandoned and the water connections to the water system are being cut off. And therefore, there is a great deal of reason to be skeptical of tap water. It seems like if you came into this, so let's say I just moved to Flint and I knew Flint had a water problem, and there's people that have moved to Flint, believe it or not, recently into our neighborhood. And they understand the water situation. I come into it, I know what I'm getting myself into, right? I know I can't trust the water. And I think in that case, because this happened to me when my family moved to Massachusetts, you know, we built a new house and we immediately put a whole house filtration system in it. Why? Because we knew the water was crap. And so we didn't, I didn't want my, and guess what? I wouldn't drink the water and I wouldn't let my children drink the water even though we had a whole house filtration system. But the company that put it in, you know, challenged me. They tested the water in my water bottle because we were buying bottled water. And this goes back, my children were like in preschool. And the bottled water tested worse than the water we were drinking out of our taps that had been filtered. But I knew what I was getting into, you know. And but even then, I wanted to drink. And it took me a while, even though I saw the scientific evidence.
Yeah.
And no one had tried to fool me and say my water was good, and I right. drink it, and I, you know, smelled it, and it looked bad, and it tasted bad, and they kept telling me it's okay. You know, maybe they said then get over it. But I don't blame you. I think it will be maybe a generation, but hopefully not, where we can, and a lot of it will have to do with, you know, I start trusting, you start trusting, and then someone else starts trusting, and they say, well, you know, they seem to be all right with it. Maybe it's time that we began to deal with trust. So,
yeah, the insidious part of it for me and my house was the water never was colored. The water never smelled. It always looked absolutely normal.
Right. So,
and
yeah.
then it came back, no, you're really poisoned.
Yeah.
And all the guilt that goes along with that.
Oh, my gosh.
Why didn't I do something sooner?
Right, right.
You
know,
because you were, oh, well, it looks good to me.
Yeah.
Nothing's changed.
Yeah, and some of us chose denial over, you know, feeling guilty. And,
yeah.
But whatever way we cope with it, it is, insidious is a good way to describe it. Even if it's not intentional, it still is the reality.
It is.
You know, and I'm, you know, maybe because of my vocation, I'm not one for going and trying to prosecute people and determine what was their intention. But at the same time, the reality is what it is. And the fact that we've had that done to us, and those who were the doers are suggesting that not only should they're done helping, but, you know, we should just get over the fact that, you know, that they ever did that to begin with, pretend
right.
like it never happened.
Right.
That seems ludicrous. But I'm not surprised, unfortunately, because of the climate of the political landscape that we're operating in.
Yeah, and I would totally agree with that. On a very positive note, in spite of all of this that was done to us, and there are some who even say, in spite of this criminal act that was done to us, the resiliency of the people of this community is remarkable.
Oh, yes, I think we have seen that people are capable in a very positive way of doing much more than I ever imagined they were capable of doing.
Yep.
And so I, and again, maybe it's my vocational hazard, but I look for the positive outcomes even in the face of disaster. And if I were going to, and so I'm always looking for that, and I'm saying, okay, so here's one thing that's happened. We lived in a very disconnected neighborhood. No one trusted each other. People were always afraid that if they leave their house, their neighbor's going to break into their house. Very early into the water crisis, we're delivering water door to door, trying to find out where our, because we didn't know who couldn't come out and get water early on. We didn't know who the folks are that we're now delivering water to. And so we're knocking on doors, and we have neighbors saying, you know, I'm okay, which was already unusual. You know,
yep.
I'm here with something free, and you're turning it down. That was a good start. And the second is, could you check on the lady, the man, the person across the street, down the road a ways? I noticed that it looked like they wouldn't be capable of getting water, and I just am concerned about them. I didn't think I would ever hear that in our community, at least, you know, when I first began pastoring here, because I felt that was the number one problem we had. We were disconnected. We hadn't yet realized that my well-being depends on your well-being, and
yep.
your well-being depends on mine.
Yep.
And so I would be, you know, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't quote scripture, but there's something in Jeremiah that says, to work for the prosperity of the city where I put you.
Yes.
And I believe that that comes full circle.
Well, I appreciate you taking some time this afternoon to talk with me about I hate to say adventures, but our trials and tribulations of the last 4 years as
right.
we've dealt with this in our community.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Bob Brown and to our guest, Pastor Tommy. And thank you for listening. This has been Community and University from the Center for Community and Economic Development.